You're listening to Rendezvous with a Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rendezvous with a Writer, where readers and writers meet, and story is everything. We're your hosts tonight, Jim and Bobby Bell.
And we're delighted that you're joining us again this week for another wonderful time with an author. That was Hot Texas Swing Band that just started off the show, and we thank them for that. And Jim, who is our guest tonight?
Brian Andrews.
Yay!
And Andrews and Wilson. And what?
Hey, everybody. So glad, thanks for having me.
We're so excited to have you back with us, Brian. The last time you were with us, I have a little stack of books here. The last time you were with us, oh my goodness, we talked about Dempsey. Yes. And about not wanting to be in a Russian prison.
That's right.
Particularly true now, isn't it?
And tonight we're going to talk about, oh my gosh, another new thrillers, 4 minutes. But before we get started, Jim has a little introduction for you.
We do.
So in like less than 4 minutes, we're going to start, Brian.
Yeah, this will not take 4 minutes. Brian Andrews is a U.S. Navy veteran, a Park Leadership Fellow, and former submarine officer with a psychology degree from Vanderbilt and a master's in business from Cornell. Brian also is a principal contributor at Career Authors, a site dedicated to advancing the careers of aspiring and published writers. Welcome.
Yeah. And where are you joining us from tonight?
I'm in Kansas City tonight.
Oh,
Kansas City.
Okay. Yeah, you guys get around. We time that you were on with us, of course, your writing partner Jeff was also with us, and I was having some fun looking on your Facebook page and Nashville. You had kind of a fun thing at the Opry in like October of last year. I don't know if you were there or that was Jeff or you were both there, but anytime there's a picture of the Grand Ole Opry, I get excited.
Yeah, I think that was a fundraiser in the fall for Seal Legacy. And it's a fantastic organization that we support.
Yeah, yeah. And since the last time you were here, let's get caught up. You released at least 2 books and maybe more. And why don't you tell us just a little something about them? We'll start with Sons of Valor 3, War Machine. You want to tell us a little bit of the backstory to this book?
Yeah, great. Thanks for asking. So for any of your listeners who've read the Tier 1 series, you held up the Dempsey cover earlier. So that's book number 7 in the Tier 1 series. But the fans of that series might remember there's a sort of a cameo character. His name is Lieutenant Commander Keith Redman. His nickname is Chunk. And Chunk showed up in the second book in the series, War Shadows. And right away, you know, we sort of introduced Chunk a little bit as maybe a counterbalance to Dempsey, and Chunk provided some comic relief, and turns out everybody really liked him. And so we kept getting lots of mail about Chunk, and so we brought him back. He came back in Crusader 1 for a little cameo, and then he was back in Red Spectre and Collateral. So he's been in 4 of the Tier 1 books. And then we sort of had this idea that maybe we would give Chunk his own series. And so we approached our publisher, Blackstone, and pitched the idea of, you know, Chunk being the lead. And so that's how the Sons of Valor series was born.
Oh. Okay. And then another book that just feels like it's just caught right out of the headlines, The Sandbox. And when you were with us the last time, this was going to be coming out, and you had told us a little bit about it. And of course, now it's been out a while, but please tell us about this book.
Thanks. Yes. So that book is another, what I would say, standalone thriller that's outside of the Tier 1 universe, sort of like 4 Minutes is. It doesn't have the same characters as the Tier 1 books does. But, you know, we're very excited about Sandbox. And that book was sort of the product of us talking about artificial intelligence and the way that it's going to create an intersection with people. In their professional lives, but also in their personal lives. And when we started writing that book, it was probably 2019 is when we started working on that book. And, you know, we started it, we wrote most of it, took a little break, came back to it. And we finished it several years before we ended up publishing it. It just sort of worked out that when it came out, it was right about the time that ChatGPT was in the news and a lot of attention is being paid to artificial intelligence. And so a lot of the themes that we tried to address in fiction, you know, are sort of coming true in real life. Mm-hmm. Obviously, this is a much more advanced artificial intelligence, but, you know, we're already at the stage where, you know, ChatGPT can carry on conversations with people, can write, it can take the SAT, can take the MCAT, you know, it can write blog posts or screenplays. So, I mean, the capacity that artificial intelligence has now is stuff that, you know, 2 years ago was science fiction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's so very timely. You know, when we were talking about ChatGPT, I remember last fall, some coworkers talking about AI. I had no idea. And it had been around and it'd been in the new. I mean, it wasn't so totally new, but it wasn't on our lips, you know, it wasn't something that was coming up in just regular conversation. And then it just feels like it's caught more and more speed. Mm-hmm. It's just moving so fast, you can hardly keep up with what it can do.
Yeah. And I think it starts to redefine, you know, I mean, I think a lot of creatives and just, you know, professionals in general, we took great pride in the fact that, you know, our ability to synthesize information and generate content is what separated us from machines. And now you have artificial intelligence that can do a lot of those same tasks. So it's pretty easy to feel threatened when, you know, if whether you're a PA or a legal assistant or a newspaper reporter or a blogger, you know, these things, these professions are in jeopardy. Mm-hmm. I think as a writer, you know, my job is potentially in jeopardy too once ChatGPT starts spitting out novels. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of a scary time.
Yeah, it's kind of scary. Somebody who couldn't even read is now pumping out some written work. No,
well,
what a thought.
And I think AI plays a little bit of a role in 4 Minutes. I think, don't they use some AI to anticipate some things or read some knowledge to help them get through some stuff? Or am I just confusing books?
No, you're right. It was a very subtle sort of element. So you picked up on it, which is really cool. We just, they had so much information to well, maybe we'll just kick off.
Yeah, we'll just. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So let's talk about 4 Minutes. And I'm going to hold up the book again. And thank you so much, because we each got a copy of it. And you can see we have lots of notes and things in our books.
That's great.
We really appreciate your publisher making that available for us. So, yeah, do you want to just kind of get started on 4 Minutes?
Yeah. So the basic premise of 4 Minutes is, especially for folks that have served in the military or read our types of books like Tier 1, you know, one of the biggest challenges in counterterrorism operations is trying to get accurate, timely intelligence. And so if you think about like 9/11, for example, there were lots of signs in retrospect, you know, that this event was going to happen. But the information hadn't been synthesized and it wasn't predicted in time that we could intervene. So the towers were attacked, you know, the Pentagon. And so if you could say, well, what if you could go back in time and get that sort of information, would we have done things differently? And that's sort of a common science fiction idea, maybe trope that, you know, let's go back in time and try to change things. And so Jeff and I were talking about that, and we wanted to do a time travel book, but we didn't want to do something like everybody else had already done. And so we said, well, what if we approached the problem differently? What if instead of going in the past, what if you could get a glimpse in the future? And maybe instead of trying to change stuff in the past, you try to use that knowledge of the future to make different decisions in the present. Mm-hmm. So if you knew that the towers were going to be attacked in 3 weeks, you'd have 3 weeks to find the terror cell and generate an operation to go capture them and prevent it from happening. And so when you think about counterterrorism, that intelligence component, you know, getting the intelligence that's accurate and getting it in time and being able to synthesize all the data, that's the tricky part. These operators, these Navy SEALs and Army Special Forces, they can't go in and hit the compound and catch the terrorists if they don't know where they are and what they're planning to do. Mm-hmm. So that intelligence piece is really tricky. And so that's where the idea for 4 minutes came, is what if you could have a crystal ball and look into the future and see what was going to happen.
Mm-hmm. I know you have questions. I think I've been doing all the talking. So the next 4 minutes are yours.
Yes, Jim, fire away.
Let's back up a bit here. When did you start writing yourself? And when did you and Jeff start collaborating?
That's a great question. So, I started writing probably 2008, 2009, something like that. I had gotten out of the military. I had started a business. But while I was in the military, you know, I used to tell stories just to pass the time. Sometimes on the submarine, we'd have long transits, or we'd have periods where the submarine's rigged for quiet. And so if you're standing watch, if you're not standing watch and you're not doing anything to do, you have to pass the time and be quiet about it. So I would collect stories. When I go to port, I'd find out funny things that happened from other guys on other boats. And I'd have my own stories from college and high school and the Navy. And I would sort of save these stories up, and then I would dole them out over time when I got deployment, just for conversation and stuff. And when I left the Navy, I remember this one guy sort of pulled me aside and he said, "Hey, it was great working with you, and you're a great storyteller. Have you ever thought about writing a book?" And I said, "Oh, no, I haven't thought of that." But he put that idea in my brain. And then after that, it was just inevitable that I would give it a try. So I wrote my first book right before my daughter was born, and sort of tried to get that thing done and finished up, because I knew when the baby would come, I wouldn't have a lot of time. And after I wrote it, I got an agent and we sold it. And I started going to these writers' conferences to learn more about, you know, the craft of writing and storytelling and networking and publishing in general. And I met Jeff at the International Thriller Writers Conference, which is in New York. ITW is what it's called. And we became friends. And it's that friendship and interest in writing that sort of spurred us to decide to co-write together.
That's great. You know, I think I asked a question the last time I talked to you fellows. And you had a very unique program, the way you write back and forth, because I asked you one time, I said, "Well, you know, you allowed the other fellow to do a little editing on what you just wrote. Does it ever irritate you?"
Well, I mean, I think if we had started we laid some ground rules from the beginning. Okay. So the short answer to your question is no, it doesn't bother us, because the only reason why is because when we first started out, we said, well, if we're going to collaborate, we need to sort of reframe the way we look at the business and the art of writing. It's not about generating a nice piece of prose on page 87 that you're really proud of and you say, "I wrote that." It's more about, hey, we want to tell a really great story. We want to entertain. We want to provide some food for thought. We want people to feel like when they read one of our Anders and Wilson books that they had this really immersive, great experience. Mm-hmm. And so it's the end product that ultimately we care about. Mm-hmm. And so we know that end product is not going to just happen magically. We have to put a lot of effort into it. There's going to be creative friction. There's going to be ideas. There's going to be changes. There's going to be stuff that I don't think of that he thinks of, and vice versa. Okay. And so that, when you look at it, the process that way from the beginning, you say, well, it's not going to be perfect on the first pass, and we're not going to figure it out until we've already written a rough draft, and then we go back and try to identify the things that could make it better. If you approach it that way, then having somebody change things, instead of it being something you take personal, you actually flip it around and you say, oh, he just made the book better because he found something that was confusing or didn't fit or maybe wasn't in keeping with that character. And so that's the way we look at it.
Yeah. In 4 minutes, there's a lot of dialogue. As the reader, we get a lot of the background of the science and how things are going to, you know, how this is all going to kind of work. It's not done through some type of a data dump. We get it because the characters are asking questions and getting answers. And so we get to get the same questions and answers too. And I was curious with dialogue, especially since some of the dialogue has all the team members together, do you each sort of initially kind of take a couple of the characters and say, okay, I'm gonna write Tyler and I'm gonna write Adela, and how do you write dialogue?
Oh, that's a great question, Bobby. So first thing I'll say is I just want to throw this comment out there. It's interesting that you notice that there's a lot of dialogue in 4 minutes. And as we have written more books, we have found that we're writing more dialogue.
Ah.
And I think it's because we talked and we realized that when we're readers, it's the dialogue that tends to be the most interesting, right? And so we've shrunk the amount of narrative and we've expanded the amount of dialogue in all of our books. If you were to read an early Anderson Wilson book versus 4 minutes, there's a significant larger proportion of dialogue. And that's just, I think, our evolution as writers and you know, sort of telling the types of stories that readers like. So that's cool that you noticed that, first of all. And then to answer your question, no, we don't actually take characters and sort of stick with them the whole time through. What we do is we do take a point of view. So, you know, he might write Tyler Brooks in chapter 2 or 3, but then I'll write him later in maybe 5 or 6. And same with Z Williams or Stan, or, well, Stan didn't have a POV in that book, but Moody. So, you know, it's fun as a writer to get to have the headspace of those characters. And we don't want to cheat the other guy out of that opportunity. So we both want to write.
Go ahead.
You got to be consistent. So what happens sometimes is in the beginning, now remember, we're passing the chapters back and forth as we write them. So whoever takes the first pass on, say, Tyler Brooks's headspace, because you're writing his chapter from the POV first, the other guy's going to read it and say, okay, I sort of get a flavor for what this guy's like, you know, or this woman is like, you know, in Z's case, I sort of get a sense for what she's like. And then we're kind of like feeling our way into their personality. And after we have a couple chapters under our belt, sometimes we'll have a conversation, not very often, every once in a while, a conversation. I'll say, you know, you had Adela say this, and I don't feel right. I see her like this. Yeah. And he might be like, oh yeah, I see her differently. And sometimes we have to meeting of the minds, and then we'll have to sort of default to one person's sort of view of that character. But I'd say like 80% of the time, like just that process of reading the other person's chapter first sort of introduces that character to the other one, and we sort of stick with that as we go.
Yeah.
You know, this might be a little out of place to ask the question right now, but our character Stan. Now Stan's got a lot of different attributes here. Here's a guy who's practically a killer, but he's got a great sense of humor. And he remembers everything he read, and he likes to put different names on different places. People.
Yeah.
Did you folks go back and forth on how you created this guy?
Yeah, when we were writing Stan, you know, the first time Stan shows up is on the airplane when Tyler is showing up at the facility, and he gets on the plane, and Stan's already there, and you know, we I don't remember. I had had breakfast with somebody who had ordered Eggs Benedict, and I just threw it in there. And then we thought that was funny. And so we started saying that, you know, a lot of these really, really intelligent people that you run across in life, especially people that have eidetic memories, sometimes they're a little bit eccentric, you know. And, you know, I knew a couple of guys when I was in the submarine community. And these are nuclear engineers. These are guys that are really smart. There was one guy in my nuclear power school class when he shows up, you know, after class would end, our classes would go to eight, from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. And after class in the classroom, he just started in the upper left corner of the classroom where all the reference books are. And there's like five rows of books, and I mean, tons and tons of reference books. And he just starts reading them. And he read through every single book. Oh, wow. And then after he was done in a couple of months, you know, when class would end, he'd just go home. And he didn't study at all. And I remember later I was like, dude, you know, like, what's up? You know, like, cause he'd get the first or second highest score on every test. And they, in the Navy, they post everybody's grades. So you get to see, oh yeah, they're smart person, they're the dumb person. You know, you see who's dumb, who's smart, that sort of thing. And no shame. I mean, you can't hide. And he was always first or second in every test. And I remember I came up to him, I was like, man, like, you have a photographic memory or something? He's like, oh no, I don't have photographic memory. He's like, I just don't forget anything I read. So that was sort of okay. a little bit of this for Stan. Okay. It's just, you know, this guy who, you know, every single thing he reads, it's in there, it's locked in, he'll never forget it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you have these types of gifts, sometimes, you know, life can be boring, you know, because, you know, mm-hmm. you need stimulation. Because, so, you know, for people like Stan, a lot of times, you know, messing with people, joking around, yes. something novel. Yeah, I think novelty is important too. If you have an eidetic memory, you're like, oh, I've seen that, read mm-hmm. that, you know, mm-hmm. know that, you know, so you're always looking for these little chunks of new information or something interesting somebody says to provide some spice to your day. And so that's mm-hmm. kind of the metaphor with Stan naming things, you know, the spice of life, his naming things, the pepper grinder and the salt shaker and stuff. That's yeah. kind of a metaphor.
Yes, definitely metaphor. We're going to take a very quick break. And when we come back, we're going to get more into some of the other characters because this team is amazing. So don't go away. And here's where you can get all of the books that we're talking about tonight and all the books from all of our guests from Rendezvous with the Writer. And we'll be right back.
Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shop's bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com, find books and CDs on the menu, choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Rendezvous with the Writer. Special guest, Brian Andrews. And we're talking about this great book, 4 Minutes.
Oh my gosh. It's such a fun, you'll be on the seat, on the edge of the chair. You want to just keep turning the pages. And you know, when you were talking about characters a moment ago, it reminded me that, you know, for a reader, especially this type of a book, we need constant conflict, don't we? And we need to see the characters and learn how they'll handle that conflict. And sometimes it's in an actual physical, you know, adventure that they have. But because there's so much dialogue, we're also getting conflict in the dialogue. And so we never really can take a breath until Stan does something funny. You know, we do need we need those moments, like any team, even within the team, they kind of, you know, they kind of need that. And tell us a little bit more about, is it Adela? How do you pronounce her name?
Yeah, Adela.
Adela. Yeah. The two ladies on the team are just amazing. But tell us about, she's just so sassy. Tell us about her. Adela.
Well, I think Adela is interesting in that, you know, she doesn't get a point of view in the book, but like you said, in just the small number of interactions that she has, you really get a sense for her personality. And she is somebody who we imagined, you know, had spent quite a bit of time downrange. So she was CIA for most of her career, and she was operating, you know, in the sandbox. So she's, you know, in the Middle East. She's hunting down terrorists. She's working with a ground branch, which is a bunch of operators. And so, you know, she's got thick skin. She's doesn't shy away from conflict or danger. And, you know, her BS meter is finely calibrated, right? Because she knows what she's doing and when somebody's trying to, you know, sort of maybe pull one over on her or manipulate her. And so we needed sort of a foil for Moody a little bit because he's such a smooth talker and he's so good at sort of manipulating the team to really get the results that he needs. And she's kind of the bullshit detector. And that's sort of what's interesting about her. And because of that, you know, it sometimes puts, and you've probably been in this situation with people, you know, if you're the devil's advocate in the room or you're the one who's sort of like, you know, the sand in the gears, that's kind of a tough role to be in because it automatically, people are like, what's that person's problem? Like, why are they being, you know, why aren't they getting with the program, right? But you need somebody like that on every team. You need somebody who is going to question and maybe help keep people from groupthink. And so, you know, that was her role and that's who she is. And, you know, it takes her a little while to warm up and trust anybody on the team, quite frankly. She's a little bit suspicious of everybody.
Well, the premise, of course, is this amazing team, and each one has a real gift.
Special skill.
Yeah. And all of those skills are needed for what they're going to do.
Yeah.
Because you, as the authors, what did you do with this team?
Yeah, so now we'll get into sort of, and this isn't a spoiler, it's in the title, it's called.
Right.
So what happens is this team is recruited because DARPA, which is the Research Advanced Projects Agency for the Army, it's a real organization, DARPA's real, and they're inventing all kinds of stuff to support the military. We imagine that DARPA was working on a modular fusion reactor. It's a design called a tokamak, and you'll see these in the news. They generate a massive magnetic field, and they're trying to sustain plasma inside this to generate energy. And so right now, the amount of time that these magnetic fields can be maintained is around 4 minutes is sort of the record for maintaining these fields. And so we thought, well, what if, you know, they're trying to make a modular fusion reactor, they're trying to make this, but what happens is they end up inventing time travel accidentally. So, you know, their machine can only stay turned on, the field is only stable for 4 minutes. So when you send someone to the future, they can only stay for 4 minutes as long as you can maintain this field. As soon as the field collapses, they get snapped right back to the present. And so we thought it'd be interesting to put that constraint on the time travel so that you can only stay amount of time that in all practical purposes sort of feels useless, right? I mean, we were like, you can go 4 minutes, but what good is that? So then we thought, well, what good is it? What could you do? And that's where we came up with the idea of, well, you would try to collect as much intelligence from the future as possible. And you would need people that had eidetic memories because they would need to memorize it all. And they don't have time to take notes or write it down. They have to just look at it and absorb it. And then you would need some sort of way to curate the information. That's where, Bobby, your comment earlier, the artificial intelligence, we just imagine a sort of simplistic AI that simply is scouring all the news feeds to prioritize what has happened, you know, over the past 14 days or whatever, so that the operators, when they go, they can focus on in a hierarchy, most important, and just work their way down the list. And so they travel to the future, they collect intelligence, and then if they see an attack or clues or precursor events to potential war or something like that, they come back to the present, and then they try to interdict and stop it before it can happen.
Yes.
You know, the leaders of the teams. Now we probably want to talk about Tyler Brooks for a moment, but we got this guy, Tom Moody, who seems to
Moody. I'm sorry. I don't mean
Pat Moody. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
For some reason we've been saying Tom Moody to each other and we're like, no, we must know somebody.
Probably know a Tom Moody.
Yeah. And then he reports to a general and we're not sure that general reports to anybody.
Yeah,
so are all these operations as secretive?
Are they all what?
All the operations that the SEALs take on is secretive, and it seems like that.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
very few players.
I mean, in real life, you have different levels of intelligence compartmentalization. So, you know, different organizations, you know, special operations depends on, you know, they might be tasked to do something that is supported and known broadly by, you know, the Navy. Or, you know, it might be highly compartmentalized where only just a handful of people know about it. And so, you know, when you start getting, especially the more clandestine type of operations in denied areas, the circle of people that know about it is very small. And so, you know, when you have this is sort of the next step. So they take Tyler and Z, they're recruited from the JSOC SEAL team and Stan's recruited from Delta Force. And I think Ben was with AFSOC, which is Air Force Special Forces. And they take these elite operators and they put them on a task force. And now the task force is sort of removed from everything else. The task force is only dealing with information that's fed to them by the command that owns the task force. So that's highly, highly compartmentalized. So Task Force Omega, in this case, which is what the story is about, they're only getting tasking from Moody and the general.
So I know we don't want to do spoiler alerts. There are some things that happen as they do the jump, like kind of jump into the future. And then, as you say, they're pulled back. One of the side, like we maybe talk about a side effect, though, when they come, there's deja vu. They all talk about very strong deja vu. So you guys, as authors who are thinking about time travel, and I'm sure you probably read a lot of things about time travel. Is it expected? What's going to happen someday? Maybe it's already happening. And is deja vu going to be probably a big sort of side effect as we come back to the present?
I don't know. I mean, it seemed like something that. It felt like to us that seemed plausible. We played around with different immediate biological and psychological impacts from traveling. And we thought that would be, especially if you're only going for a very short amount of time and time does something to you, to your psyche when you leave and come back, it seemed like deja vu would be a possible outcome, right?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, they have this really disconcerting sense of deja vu. And it's not something that they ever really get used to. You know, they expect it. But every time it happens, it feels the same. You know, it feels quite strong to them. And you hear them comment, they don't like it. You know, they don't like it.
They don't like, no, they don't like it. Do you have, go ahead.
Tyler Brooks, did you want to just say a few words about this guy?
Yeah, Tyler, yes.
Yeah, so Tyler, we played around with, you know, what type of hero he would be and what his eidetic memory would be. And ultimately, we decided that he didn't have any. So we thought it would be really, really fun if he's this guy that's like supposed to lead. And, you know, he's the one that needs a Sharpie to write down something on his hand because he's not going to remember it. And, you know, what would that feel like? Because we wanted him to feel like a fish out of water in the role because he'd been very good at, very comfortable at what he'd been doing with the SEALs. So he's very good at special operations and very good at leading. But what he's not necessarily good at is the type of role that we are testing him with, which is, you know, and at least in the early parts of the book, you know, they're collecting intelligence. They're not out there shooting people. So, you know, he's having to exercise a different part of his brain and a different type of leadership than he's done before. And I think because he feels inadequate, you know, that challenges him. Mm-hmm. Would you agree?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. We also see that it doesn't take long for everybody to figure out why he's the team leader, though.
Yeah.
That's the one thing he's really good at.
Yeah.
And I think that's what anyone who's met somebody who has charisma and is a natural born leader, I think that's why that term exists, natural born leader, because they can't help themselves. Mm-hmm. It's in their DNA and they're going to lead and they know how to lead. And it might take them a little longer to find out how to lead an eclectic team than it would be, you know, a group of SEALs. But he does. He rises to the challenge because that's the type of guy that he is. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not going to just quit and give up.
Right. And he's very good at reading. He is very good at reading people.
Yes.
Yeah.
As is Z.
She, yes.
You know, and the two of them, of course, had worked together previously. The book opens with a very riveting special op that they're on, and there's a surprise. Suddenly, Z is you want to? I guess it couldn't really be. It so happens so in the beginning of the book that it's not really a spoiler alert. But
yeah.
You want to tell us about that? How the book opens, what's going on?
Yeah, so it sort of opens with what's perceived as an intelligence failure. So that's kind of what we were talking about when we opened the show today with 9/11. It's like a lot of people will say, well, this is an intelligence failure. Mm. The signs were there and we didn't see them. We didn't act on them. So, you know, Z is the intelligence officer for the SEAL team that Tyler is on. And they're going to hit a compound to try to capture a bomb maker. And the mission goes south because there's additional insurgents that they don't anticipate. Mm-hmm. And so Tyler is under the impression that it's an intelligence failure and it's Z's fault. And she feels pretty bad about it. Mm. She feels like she must have missed something. Of course, she didn't miss something because it's part of the plot. You know, the bad guys are somehow involved to manifest this intelligence failure and make the mission go south. But, you know, Tyler doesn't know that. Z doesn't know that. So she's blaming herself. He's trying not to blame her, but he can't help himself. He kind of has to blame her. And so when they get recruited away from the SEAL team to go work on Task Force Omega, you know, they show up with this very uncomfortable baggage because mm-hmm. The last time that they had spoken, they had been in an argument. And so that's something we sort of played around with. We did a couple drafts of this book, and, you know, the first draft, we sort of stretched that out for a pretty long time and it felt too long. It didn't feel professional. So then in the rewrite, we kind of came back and we have them, you know, sorted out earlier and we have Tyler sort of recognize, and this speaks to his leadership and his personality. You know, we have Tyler recognize pretty quickly, like, you know what, I was kind of a jerk and I owe you an apology. So, you know, he takes that first step to say I was wrong.
Yeah.
You know, you did. I thought you guys did a very good job with that idea. You know, that you didn't kind of dwell on it, but you really got to the point pretty quick. And he realized, you know, that he needs to make a little change there. And mm-hmm. His working relationship with Z, and I thought you handled it very well.
Yeah. So every book has to have really bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
And you have some really bad guys in this book. Do you want to just take a moment and talk about the bad guys?
Sure. So, so this book. The bad guys are kind of like, what's a good word? They're like the mirror image of mm-hmm. Task Force Omega in mm-hmm. the sense of, like, you know, where Tyler and Z and Stan and Ben, they're trying to do their best to safeguard the country and they're doing it, for patriotic reasons. Imagine now you've got an organization that's sort of in reverse where they're doing it for, you know, personal reasons and financial gain. Mm-hmm. So this is sort of like, I would say, like the operator night, the nightmare version of an operator, you know, a mercenary, somebody who's highly trained and but has decided to give up on, you know, the give up their moral compass. Mm-hmm. And now they're sort of just guns for hire, but they're just as capable, mm-hmm. you know, and just as talented as the good guys. And, you know, I always used to say, you know, when you watch like a superhero movie that the superheroes are always at a disadvantage because the bad guys can cheat and the superheroes can't, right? and there's truth to that. You know, that's right. The Achilles heel of being a good guy is that you can't cheat.
Right.
And so we played around with that, you know, on a non-superhero level. You know, it's a theme we wanted to have in this book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're, it's hard to talk about this book and not want to go talk about things that we want our listeners and our watchers to go get the book, because there are some major things that we just can't tell you about. We just have to be coy and say, go read the book. Let me just quickly, I know we had some other, questions.
You fellows had a lot of experience in the warfare and the ops and the military. Did you need to do a lot of research, or could you take a lot of things just from your own personal experience?
This book, we didn't have to do a lot of research. So that's one of the fun things about our sort of our techno thrillers is we don't have to research the operations or the, you know, there's not a lot of current military means and methods in it. It's more just sort of us extrapolating, you know, what this technology would be and how it's used. And so what we did have to sort of research is a little bit on time travel. And so, you know, there's lots of theories on time travel, and obviously nobody knows how it exactly works. We do know that time is not fixed. I mean, we think in our minds it's fixed, but we know it's influenced by gravity. So if you have an atomic clock that's located at sea level and you have one on the International Space Station, time is going to be going at a different rate, you know, further away from gravity than you are. We know that it's fascinating. We know that time changes as you move closer to the speed of light. So, you know, for the observers, time is moving at a much faster rate than somebody who is approaching the speed of light. So if you're approaching the speed of light, you travel for a year, Earth would age, you know, hundreds of years.
That's one of the things I think too about the book that, as a reader, you get caught up in the people and the action, but then you also stop. I found myself rereading sections. You know, they're asking questions of Pat Moody, and he's providing some of those answers. And like you said earlier, he's very smooth. But we're laymen, and to a degree, so are these characters with this particular situation. And so he's very... he puts it out in layman terms where, as a reader, I really believed, you know, we believe our authors, we follow our authors.
Yeah.
And I just felt like y'all have done time travel because it is explained so easily that you just wonder, well, how could it not be happening? And this is even how we come back, you know, and so I think that was the other thing that was so enjoyable about the read was, and you said it earlier, being pensive, having time to really think through some of the concepts and understand. So when they did do these moments, 4 minutes of travel, we kind of could understand, okay, this is what's happening now. This is how this is possible.
Yeah. And, there was a really interesting, and this happened when we were first working through like the first draft of the novel, you know, all the jumps were, you know, into the, you know, couple weeks into the future. You stay for 4 minutes, you come back to the present. But in our theory or in the 4 minutes universe, the way that time works is time is sort of like a riverboat and it's moving down the river. And so when you jump 4 minutes into the future, the riverboat is still moving.
Still moving.
So when you come back to the present, that 4 minutes is advanced in the past too. So it's sort of like, just in physics, we have conservation of energy, conservation of mass. We thought there's probably conservation of time. So you couldn't jump back to the time when you left because time is marching on. Whether you're spending your 4 minutes in the future or whether you're spending it in the past, time is moving.
Right.
And so that's how we use that riverboat as an explanation is, okay, you're on the riverboat. It's moving down the river of time. If you jump off the bow into the future, that thing's still moving. So when you come back to the boat, if you swim back to the boat, you're downstream however many minutes it took you to get back to the boat.
Right. Did you have a question, Jim? I'm looking at time.
Time is...
Oh, my goodness. Time, speaking of time.
That was what I was going to say. We need to ask what's next.
Well, when does this book release? Because it's pre-order right now only.
Yeah, so it comes out on April 2nd, which is next Tuesday.
Yeah.
There you go.
And and what do you have coming next?
The next book is something we're very excited about. It's called Act of Defiance, and it's a Tom Clancy book. So we're writing a book that comes out on the 40th anniversary of The Hunt for Red October.
Oh, wow.
Big submarine book.
That's great.
Yeah, and I think when we were with you before, you had mentioned that was maybe something that was going to happen in the future. So that's really exciting. And let's see, what else do we want to? Oh, well, Jim, well, and where can people find you? Where do they go? Website and all that good stuff?
Yeah, so it's andrews-wilson.com. Andrews-wilson.com. And so if you go there, you can download one of our novellas for free. You can sign up for our newsletter. We don't sell your information or trade it or give it away. We just send periodic updates to you about our new releases. And so that's the best way to stay in touch with us. And also there's a list of every book that we have with links to where you can buy it.
Yep, which is very helpful. Jim has a couple of quotes.
We do.
Great.
A couple of quotes. Now, the first one's from the book. This is from Tom Moody. He asks, what can you accomplish in 4 minutes?
Yeah.
The SEAL inside Tyler went to work answering the question. In 4 minutes, a squad can fast rope out of a Black Hawk and breach a target compound. We can board a cargo ship and start to take out the entire crew of bad guys. We can unload into an SDV and be underway from a submarine. So he's quickly thinking about 4 minutes. Now, I like this one here. This is from you guys, mm-hmm. George Burns. I look to the future because that's where I'm going to spend the rest of my life.
That's a great line. Isn't
that great one?
That's a great line. Yes.
And then I picked this one up. I thought it fed in fairly well. This is from Albert Einstein. People like us who believe in physics know that the distinction between past, present, and the future is only a stubbornly persistent illusion.
Mm-hmm. Well, we really enjoyed the book, and we enjoyed talking with you today. And please say hello to Jeff. I hope that he'll watch. And if he does, Jeff, hello to you. Yeah. And I want to just quickly say that you can catch the show on a replay on audio, up on Podbean or any of your favorite streaming podcast platforms. Just give me a little while to get it up there. And always on LA Talk Radio's website and Facebook page, where you can also see the video of it. Okay. We want to thank you, Brian, so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me. I love the show.
Well, we'll have to have you back in 2025.
Yes. That's
our guest next week is Sherry Monahan. She's a Western historian and a phenomenal chef, and she's going to be talking about two of her cookbooks. And I think, Jim, we just want to say
thank you, and it's always a great day out west.
Go read a book. We'll talk to you next week. Bye.
We'll see you.